Blog Talk Radio.
In the beginning was the beat, and the beat was the rhythm of God, and the rhythm of God is the harmony of humanity, and where there is harmony, there is peace.
Welcome, brothers and sisters, to the Us Lifting Us Thursday night Dare to Win radio broadcast. We are excited to talk to our family here in the United States, throughout the Caribbean, in South America, on the continent of Africa, in Europe, and everywhere Black-descended Africans are in the diaspora. So again, welcome to Dare to Win. My name is Brother Kimbizi. I'm one of the founding board members of Us Lifting Us and your host for this evening's program. Here at the Dare to Win program, we have a sober discussion of the systems and institutions necessary for real economic empowerment for our people. The systems and institutions of the past have not worked. New models are required, and Us Lifting Us is leading the way in building this new economic paradigm. It is not enough that we struggle. We must build and maintain ways and means that ensure our success, not only for ourselves, but for future generations. We're excited to be here this evening. I'm joined by Brother Shabaka, another board member of Us Lifting Us. And we're going to explore some questions tonight. One, are Black people placed in modern-day wage slavery as we participate in the American economy? And what is wage slavery? Also, we saw in the news recently where General Motors is laying off 14,000 of their workers and shutting plants down in Michigan and Ohio and Canada. And the impact of how this is going to affect these families, and is there a solution that working people and community people can put forward to save ourselves in the midst of this kind of economic turmoil? These and other questions we will explore tonight. I will be joined, again, as I said, by Brother Shabaka. And so on the other side of the music break, prepare your thoughts and plan to be a part of the conversation.
In the beginning was the beat, and the beat was the rhythm of God, and the rhythm of God is the harmony of humanity, and where there is harmony, there is peace. The mother, we are civilization during the dark ages. are kings and queens with land that stretch from ocean to ocean as the mighty Nile flows from the south at Lake Victoria, where Eve is called Lucy, northward to Egypt, where Moses went down to the get down. From the south to the north, yeah, moving up the right way. We are all that. And across the history of this vast continent of countries, the drum.
Again, welcome to Us Lifting Us, Dare to Win Thursday evening radio broadcast. My name is Brother Kimbezi, and I'm joined tonight by Brother Shabaka, one of our board members. Brother Shabaka, how are you feeling this evening?
Greetings, brother. I am feeling fine. The weather is nice, and you got a very stimulating topic to talk about, so I'm very happy to be with you. I'd like to greet the family, audience. And I hope that they participate as we discuss this very important question and topic that you have raised. So I'm feeling very good and feeling very great. Thank you for asking.
All right. To join the conversation tonight, call 929-477-2789. Again, that's 929-477-2789. If you have a question or a comment you'd like to make, press the number 1 on your phone. That'll raise your hand, so to speak, and the switchboard will see you, and we'll come to you and hear your question or your comment. Also, if you haven't already done so, we invite you to visit our webpage at usliftingus.com. That's usliftingus.com. where you can get a full explanation of the Us Lifting Us Economic Development Cooperative appeal and plan, the strategy that we are putting in place, the goals that we have set, and the progress that we're making towards those goals. So, again, we invite you to visit our webpage, usliftingus.com, become familiar with our strategy, give us some feedback, let us know what you think. And then if it makes sense to you, click the join button and become a member of Us Lifting Us. Brother Shabaka, let's get into the conversation. So are black people placed in servitude or modern-day wage slavery from the wage economy that most of us find ourselves here in North America? Help us understand that and what you mean, what we're talking about when we say wage slavery.
Thank you for the question, brother. In fact, not only black people, but a number of other people, which you had in your introduction, talked about the laying off by General Motors. It gives an indication. But to bring it, to bring this topic home, yes, we are in a servitude type of position. When you think of slavery, of course, we've had our ancestral experience with that. You think of a human being empowered by the society to have power over another human being, all right, and then have that human being basically control every aspect of their lives, working, serving in any type of capacity. You're being controlled by someone else, and it's being sanctioned by the state or at least the society. So we think of that when you tack on wage, and usually this generally has come about as a consequence during the early part. These terminologies that we're using are basically English terminologies, and of course, you know, English is not necessarily our language. It's our second language, but it's a language you had to learn in order to communicate with the Europeans who oppressed and enslaved us, our ancestors, and continue to do the same thing now. Wage slavery basically came out of the late 1800s, early 1900s, with the rise of industrialization, factories and all, et cetera, when people began to leave the land. These are the Europeans who had migrated here, and even Africans who were kidnapped and brought here. We basically produced for ourselves on the land. When we went to leave the land, moved to the north, became laborers, the assets that we had, by at least having some control or ownership, quote unquote, of land, was left behind. So as a consequence, we came to the factories. The factories were owned by other people. The other people now, all right, we had to live. We had to provide for ourselves, food, clothing, and shelter, and a few other things. We had no means of doing that unless we had to, and we didn't really have negotiation. They had control over every aspect of factory life during those late 1800s, early 1900s, and even up to the present time, as we can see from what you just announced about General Motors. All right, so consequently, as a result of that, they offered minimum wage. That's exactly what it was, to use our labor to construct what it was they were constructing to produce the goods and services that they in turn sold. And as a result of that, they had every control over our lives. We worked sometimes 13, 15 hours a day, get a little bit of sleep, and come back to work. All right, so this is the environment which produced, and then economists had equated the wage earner with being in a servitude position by the factory owners who own the facility that worked them. So we see the combination of slavery, which had preceded that, all right, some decades earlier with our labor, which was free, but still the control of the landowner having control over us, and now the factory worker, the factory owner having control over the wage earner, all right, and in every aspect of their lives. I mean, they had, during those periods, from what I've read, they really suffered tremendous conditions, and of course, the migration of Africans from the South due to the brutality we experienced and the confiscation of what little land we had in the South forced us to move to the North. And then, of course, it was a good opportunity for the factory owners because we provided a pool of very cheap labor. And so we provided a pool of very cheap labor, and as a consequence, we had some animosity and some fights with the Europeans, all right, who were themselves being cheaply labored. So we see the combination of those things and which forced us, all right, to adopt that terminology and appropriately apply that terminology. But that terminology can be readily applied to the average wage earner. But we are, since we are the last hired and first fired, it affects us a lot more. Last hired and first fired, and that practice has continued, you know, over a century. Now, a few weeks ago, we talked. Yeah, go ahead, brother. You wanted to follow up on that.
So part of what you're describing is, as a people, we moved from what is called chattel slavery, where we were just the outright property of the plantation owners. When we migrated to the factories in the north, we became wage slaves. So they didn't own us body and soul like they did on the plantation, but they substituted a wage that we were then controlled by the wage. And as you pointed out, the wage was a minimum wage, just enough to keep you getting back and forth to work every day with not a whole lot left over to actually give you a quality of life. And some have argued that the reason that the plantation owners and the industrialists moved from chattel slavery to wage slavery was that there was some hidden costs in chattel slavery. There was the constant fear of revolt. The enslaved people had to be fed and housed and clothed. But when they adopted a wage slavery system, now the workers are responsible for their own food, their own clothing, their own shelter, out of the meager wages that they're being paid, so that the system is even more profitable for those who now are the factory owners. So how do we understand in this new environment where we now are wage earners, quote unquote, we sometimes got confused between income and wealth. And we thought that the money in our paycheck was the same thing as wealth. But I think you were trying to help us to understand that there's an important difference there. Would you say something about that?
Surely, and I like the explanation that you gave, which put it all together, dealing with the wage slavery as chattel slavery. We were still enslaved. It's just that the Europeans held wages over our head, all right, and they saw an opportunity where before they had to provide for us, so they gave us a piece of the stuff because. See, the Europeans are producing goods and services. Those goods and services have to be bought by a consumer class, right? Not an ownership class, but a consumer class, and we provided that. But getting back to the question that you asked about income and wealth, income is, you know, everything is that you produce, which produces that you create and is able to sell, all right? The services and goods produced create income that's come in. A laborer produces income, you know, through his or her labor, in the process of manufacturing or creating a good or a service that is then generated and distributed to the community at large, or the nation at large. Or it create income coming in from that person. It's just that the income that comes in as derived, the European or the factory owner or the corporation takes the lion's share of that, all right, and then through some negotiation or contract, which has been heavily favored for the European, pennies are then delivered to the worker. Wealth, on the other hand, is basically the accumulation of everything that is used to create those goods and services, all right? And that can be transferred, all right, generationally, all right, where income or wages or salaries, all right, cannot. In other words, I could make $250,000. I cannot pass $250,000 down to my children if I die. But if I have something that is done with that $250,000, to create the kind of tools necessary in order to produce goods and services, and that thing is sustained, appreciates, in other words, increase in value, all right, then that can be in turn passed down, all right? And usually the economists like to use the traditional formula is that assets, which is everything that you own, factories, land, and even intellectual property nowadays, which then can be used, all right, to create goods and services. All right, you subtract your liabilities, that which you owe, out in the creation of the goods and services that your factory may be involved in. All right, so what you get is your net worth, and the net worth is a measurement of your wealth. As you can see, if you just deal with income, all right, only, or wages only, you can see that that's not necessarily going to amount to having an effective economic influence, all right, in the society that's created. It's the person who owns the factory, the tools of that factory, all right, and then produces the goods from that factory, and then is able to distribute the goods from that factory to markets, which is then exchanged for income or money that's produced, and then you get the products or the result of that process. So we see these, and then usually that's usually defines an economy where people have organized themselves or able to organize themselves, all right, so that goods and services are can be produced, distributed, and then given to the people within that society. All right, but the wealth is generated from the owners of that because they sustain that factory. When you look at the GM plants all over the place and other car manufacturers all over the place, all right, they control that. All right, GM has been in business for decades. All right, Toyota has been in business for decades. They've had those plants for decades, and they are passed down generationally, all right, for decades. All right, producing more goods and services that are sold in the marketplace. And as a consequence of that, when we look now at what are the problems that we see fostering in a society today, well, as a result of the many industries and factories and corporations producing different kinds of things, we see that the person who left the land going back decades ago to the factory has somewhat been disassociated because the person who was on the farm more than likely owned the tools that was necessary to farm, and then in owning the tools, in other words, the tools necessary to produce, in other words, if I'm on the farm in order to raise the crops, the plow, whatever they use, all right, the animal husbandry that takes place in order to produce. All right. Once I leave the factory, once I leave the land and leave the farm, all right, now I am separated. So now I do not see the goods and services that are then in the marketplace. I can see aspects of it from the labor that I'm using and doing in order to produce an aspect of that, but I've been separated from that and as a consequence alienated from that leaves us somewhat vulnerable, but the manufacturer, the factory owner, see every aspect of it. He's in control, and I say he because it's not many women up there. He's in control, and he's most definitely European or white. He's in control, and he allows, he has every aspect of it, so he's not separated. He's very much contained, so the labor that he has hired and enslaved, all right, to the final product, to the selling of that final product, all right, he creeps and benefits the most from it. The stratification as a consequence of different occupations has resulted in what we call classes, as many of you know, and, of course, the term middle class, that's been used a lot, particularly when the political people comes around. But it's a real thing because we have folks that have bows to certain skills, have been able to have the ability to develop those skills, usually through school, all right, and have been able to negotiate, so they think, a higher wage or salary, which allows them a little bit of the accumulation, which they in turn can turn into wealth-generating products, right, which they themselves can pass down, and the Europeans, middle-class Europeans, have been able to do this somewhat successfully. The Africans, middle class, have not because we have not been exposed or educated on how this is done. So we have the stratification. All right, we have the lower people who have not very much supposedly education or training, and then we have others, all right, who have a well-educated. These are the lieutenants of the owners of the corporations. They, in turn, will sometimes protect in order to sustain their own privilege, they will protect the rights of the owners. The same way we see right now, it's hard to imagine that an NBA player, mostly African, is a wage or slave salary slave, but he can be bought or sold. He can be easily bought or sold, traded, and as we see recently. If any allegations of abuse are exhibited by him, he can also be fired. So he has no rights, even though supposedly you're not guilty of any crime until you are judged by a jury of your peers, we can see that the NBA, the National Football League, have very wealthy slaves. And so, brother, I hope that outlined a little bit of when we talk about wage slavery, how that impacts, and how most of us who have wage or slaves are wage slavers, are slaves. Go ahead, brother. I'm sorry.
You made it. Yeah, thank you. You made it very clear for us. So, in to try to sum up what you just shared with us, we went from chattel slavery to wage slavery. And in both of those situations, whether we were on the plantation or in the factory, because we were not owners of the plantation or owners of the factory, we weren't able to generate real wealth. All we had was, well, under slavery, we didn't have anything. Under wage slavery, we had a little income. But what that income turned us into was consumers, which then turned around and benefited the factory owners and the wealth owning class once again. So it part of our dilemma is we find ourselves in these economic arrangements where we do not own or control these mechanisms that produce wealth. We don't control the plantation. We don't control the factory. So it seems to suggest that what we need to be thinking about is becoming owners of these institutions that are capable of producing wealth. And what you were saying about even the athletes being a form of wage slavery, and because you have athletes that are making multi-million-dollar salaries, we don't think of them as necessarily being a slave. But when Kaepernick took the knee to protest the discrimination and the police brutality against the black community, we saw very quickly how he was pushed out of being able to generate an income for himself and his family. So, yes, it makes it very real for us that we find ourselves, by and large, in a situation where we are wage slaves. And so we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back on the other side of the break, we're going to talk a little bit more about what's going on with the Detroit workers and think in terms of what kinds of solutions allow us to escape the trap of the wage slave and put ourselves in the position where we can begin to be owners and begin to generate real wealth for ourselves and our children. So stay tuned, everybody. We'll be right back in just a minute. So I can't get around it. So low, you can't get under it. So high, you can't get over it. Can't get over it. This is a chance. This is a chance to dance your way. Now the working street shuns.
Here's a chance to dance our way out of our constriction. Gonna be freaking up and down the hang-up alleyway. With a groove I only got, we shall all be moved. Ready or not, here we come. Nothing but the funk.
And we're back. If you're just joining us, we're having a conversation this evening about wage slavery and how do we break out of an economic system that does not allow us to generate real wealth. My name is Brother Kimbezi. I'm one of the board members of Us Lifting Us, and we're joined this evening by Brother Shabaka, another board member of Us Lifting Us. And just before we move to looking at the implications of the General Motors workers that were laid off, we have a caller whose last four numbers are 5259. 5259. Do you have a comment or a question? We're opening your line. Please tell us where you're from and your name, and state your comment or your question.
Yes, this is Brother Jelani out of Decatur, Georgia. And I am...
Greetings, Brother Jelani.
Hey, how you doing, Brother Kimbezi? Hey, I was...
Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear you, too. I was thinking about another aspect of this wage slavery concept that I wanted to talk about. And it's the... When you really think about it, it's so appropriate talking about wage slavery because slavery is always forced or engineered in a funneling process to take these whoever victims that you are and put them in a position so that they can't go where they want to go or that's beneficial for them, but it's beneficial for you, you know, being the oppressor. And one thing that they did, too, when slavery was over, they not only got the idea, hey, we can go ahead and enslave them back on the plantation, you know, through the crop sharing, but that was a process of keeping us from utilizing the skills that we had honed on those plantations, because we were the makers and the doers of so many doggone things. We was a real threat, but they still wanted us wherever they wanted us. So another thing they did, as far as our skills is concerned, is they went ahead and from those skills denied us the ability to utilize those skills and outlawed us even making a living with our own skills that we've learned and passed on. And so anyway, I just wanted to enter that into just the concept of being a wage slave, how they are always in the process of taking you off the road of doing something for yourself to make a leg up for yourself to gather wealth or power and funneling you in a direction that just benefits them but keeps you as a peon. So that's all I wanted to say.
We appreciate that comment, and you're right. You're certainly right on point with that. Sharecropping was a tragic example of the very point that you're making, keeping us tied to the land, supposedly planting and grooming and harvesting the crop. Supposedly we were renting the tools and the land to bring out to produce a harvest, and then at settling up time, we were supposed to get the surplus from that work. But, of course, the owners, you know, like we used to say in Bidwest, they pencil whipped us, you know. John, you owe so much for this and you owe so much for that, and we only got X amount for the harvest. And actually, John, you owe me some money, you know. So that was a tragic trap that – kept us tied to the land, and as you point out, we never got a chance to get a leg up. So we recognize, and to the other point that you made, that they always change the laws in such a way that it benefits them and it is to our detriment. So we find ourselves in that situation where we have to change the game, or if at the very least, we have to change our position in the game. So Brother Shabaka, you were going to begin to share with us, and in light of Jelani's comment, it's even more important that we understand the implications of the General Motors proposed layoff of all of these workers and the shuttering of these plants, and understand both from a values perspective the significance of what they are doing, and therefore it makes it even more immediate that we have solutions that we can put in place in this rapidly changing economic environment. So Brother Shabaka, what would you say to us about that?
Brother, thanks for bringing that up. I want to go back to the brother's comment about the skills that we had. We absorbed a lot of skills working on the plantation as slaves, all right, which is one of the reasons that we were able to get employment when we went north. All right, we were obviously from the slavery experience, all right, we were hard workers, so that was, and we had skills that we brought with us, but we were cheaper labor. We were, you know, good skills, but cheaper labor, and we were exploited. So that allowed the owners of the factories, the corporations, and what have you, all right, to exploit us. And then as there was conflict between labor, that's the European laborers and the African laborers, you know, that allowed him again to exploit and take opportunities of the battle between us in order to keep keep wages low. Because if we look at the resources, to take the resources out of the ground, you're going to need the tools to take that. The tools cost the same amount of energy to pull it out. The energy necessary, that's the same cost. But one of the flexible costs that you have, flexible cost, is that labor cost, but it's the cost that you need. In other words, the labor is what you need to do the extraction, to do the manufacturing, the customizing, and all that other kind of stuff, and even to sell, but it's some flexibility that you have in how much you pay that laborer, all right, which is why we say slavery. But getting back to the question that you were raising about General Motors, well, as you know, early part of last week, they announced that they were going to lay off 14,000 employees in North America. Supposedly, according to them, the layoffs were triggered by a change in strategy or strategic direction. Now, what do we mean by that? A change in strategic direction? You're going to lay off 14,000 people because of a change in strategic direction. Well, essentially what they're saying, you know, they look at the bottom line. They know that they're producing certain types of cars, all right? And then they gather the statistics. You know, the certain types of cars, all right, is more marketable and can be sold better than other cars that are being produced. So what they made a decision that, all right, we're going to concentrate on the production of these cars, you know, because our competitors is outmaneuvering us in the production of these cars. So that's essentially what they mean. And then a spokesperson said that General Motors recognized the need to stay in front. Now, this is General Motors. This is a spokesperson that came out there when they made this announcement. Recognized the need to stay in front of the changing market conditions and customer preferences to position its company for long-term success. Now, what does that mean? Customer preferences to position its company for long-term success. All right, at one time, I think during the oil problem that they had back then in the 70s, 80s, there was a push to get cars with higher fuel efficiency. All right, because the cars that the hogs, you know, were just gobbling up the gas, and the gas supply or the gasoline supply just was not coming into the country. All right, so consequently, that forced the manufacturers to develop cars that had much more fuel-efficient mileage. All right, now we see the talk of pollution. And then you got families. So that lends itself to the production of another type of automobile, electric, maybe vans, because you got a family. And so the kind of cars that were being produced, which you thought was high-end and that you could get rid of, you're not producing those fast. So essentially what General Motors is saying is it's looking at the market, looking at its competitors, and saying this is how we can be successful. All right, my strategy is to develop this, and therefore this plant no longer needs to exist because they're not developing that. All right, so they close that plant, although they're closing a lot of jobs. Now, it's not only the employees, the 14,000 employees that are being affected. It's all of the supporting businesses that support General Motors, all right, all of the supporting. So if you multiply that 14,000 probably times three, then you find you get other jobs that are impacted by laying off 14,000 employees of General Motors. Right, so you get because we're all tied in. You know, we got to supply this. We bring supplies in. We got to travel. We pick them up from the port because General Motors, like any car manufacturer, imports various parts from throughout the world. That's how it keeps prices cheap. All right, and so what it wants to do is rely on its plants where the labor is cheap. In other words, I got wage slaves. All right, cheaper wage slaves that are cheaper, and my thing is to always buy cheaper labor. All right, that's my flexibility. That's my variable that I have a little bit of control over if I am a company like GM, all right, General Motors, or any large company. So my thing is always to keep labor. Now, unfortunately, the employees, all right, know how to operate, know how to produce the car. They know how to bring in the parts. All right, remember now, even though they're working the assembly line and all this, they have supporting parts. You know, not everybody is doing the same thing. So they know how to put the parts together. And some of them may be unionized, but the unions have not thought of taking ownership of the plant or ownership of plants, okay? And they're making the cars and marketing themselves. All right, so the concept of cooperative economics, where we are working together, all right, has not entered. They see themselves as individual employees picking up a wage or salary and hoping that they can keep that wage or salary and go home, all right, out in the suburban area with their two-car garage and stuff like that and take their, two-week, vacation or month-long vacation, whatever it has to be. That's what they want to do. And General Motors saying, no, that's not going to happen because that's too expensive. I don't want to put money into your pension. if you leave the job, I don't want to pay for that. All right, I want cheap labor. And let me give you a brief example, somewhat connected to that, but not entirely. In the education field now, there's a need by administrators of universities to get contract adjunct educators. Now, the adjuncts are paid for per course, and they don't have to pay them like they have to pay salary professors. Salary professors, some of them are very good and get six-figure salaries. Well, adjuncts, they don't have to pay that. If they make 30 or 40,000, they're doing good. All right, so the universities don't have to pay that in the same fashion that General Motors is looking for cheaper ways. The university adjuncts have the same credentials as the salary full-time professors, but they just don't have the benefits that the unions of the professors were able to manage to gain our green negotiation with the administration. So in a similar manner, the adjuncts can be laid off, can be fired, can be thrown to the winds in the same way that General Motors is doing with these 14,000 employees. Again, the adjuncts, the full-time employees, don't think of working together cooperatively, all right, to produce the same product. They all already producing that is under the control of the people who control that industry. So we see that General Motors, as well as other corporations, are trying to reduce size. They're trying to save costs. As you probably heard, they're trying to bring in more machinery, artificial intelligence, computers, and a whole bunch of other stuff, because the computers can run longer than the individual. All you need to do is feed them electricity, right?
Brother Shabbat.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah, this is Sister Nanana calling from Denver, Colorado. How are you?
Oh, Sister, welcome. Glad to hear you.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, you said something that triggered a thought with me that I'd like to hear more about. Maybe either you or Brother Kimbizi can shed a little bit more light on. You indicated that the employees at General Motors might start to look at this whole situation from a perspective of cooperative economics, and that might be a solution for them. And so I was wanting you to say more about that and exactly what would that cooperative process look like. How would that bring resolution for them?
Well, thank you, Sister, for bringing that up. Looking at General Motors, you know, parts are coming in. You do have high salary individuals. You know, they don't have the salaries that you have with an NBA player, but they do have high salaries, all right? And then you have thousands of workers, all right? You have thousands of workers. So if they begin to think of pooling resources to buy those parts, they might not necessarily be able to sustain the factory that they're in, or at least part of the factory. They could lease part of it out temporarily, but they know they have the skills, all right, because they've been doing this for decades, years, all right. And some of them have plans. They do have pension plans that they've been able, that their unions have been able to negotiate. So they do have resources, but they haven't thought of pooling these resources together, all right, and taking over management of the plant, all right. In cooperative economics, it's essentially what we do. We pull our resources together, all right. All right, we identify what businesses have. In this case, the business of making cars. With the environment and the talk of global warming and all this, it would seem that if we had this opportunity, we would put together a car that were more conducive and applicable in an environment in which we're trying to remove all of the emissions effects that affects the climate. So they have that. They have the engineers. They have the laborers. They have the scientists. They have all of that. And so all they need to do is pool the resources. That's material from the money that they make. In addition to that, the skills that they possess, the intellectual resources. And as I said before, they know where these parts are coming from. You know, you have administrative folks, you have clerical folks that know where everything is coming from. And you can maintain the same kind of contracts, all right, except that you don't have an upper management who you're paying tens of millions of dollars for or to, and you're not responsible to a board who's responsible to stockholders other than yourself.
Brother Shabaka,
yes, brother. Yes.
If I might jump in addition to what you were saying, Sister Nanana, the solution, one very good solution would be, as Brother Shabaka mentioned, would be for the workers who will be impacted if they're laid off to form a worker-owner cooperative and buy the plant and produce the products that we need to protect the environment, i.e. electric cars or self-driving cars. Now, just to show you how dishonest and corrupt General Motors is as a corporation, they're saying that they want to get ahead of the curve and bring to market a product that people are interested in. That is the electric car. Now, we're in 2018. In the 1990s, in response to Toyota and Nissan producing electric or producing hybrid cars, General Motors experimented with an electric car. It was wildly successful. It was getting something like 80 miles to a battery charge. It could do up to 70 miles an hour. They had 75 or 80 units on the streets as testing to get customer reaction to the car. There was no gas emissions because it was completely electric. Wildly successful. But because it did not burn gas and because it was cheap to make, General Motors killed the car. They took back all the test models that they had on the street, took them to a shredder, and shredded the car so there would never be any evidence that they ever had made this car. And if that wasn't bad enough to add insult to injury, General Motors then turned around and bought the Hummer and started producing Hummers, which were getting 10 miles to the gallon of gas. But they were gas guzzlers like no other car on the street. So General Motors is lying. They took that bailout in 2008 from the government where they got billions of dollars to pull back from the brink of bankruptcy. Then they took the Trump tax break, which was another almost $1 trillion. And then they announced quarterly profits of $6 billion. So General Motors is awash in profitability. But because they are concerned with returning a share to the 1% who are stock owners, and they have absolutely no regard for those 14,000 workers who have been loyal employees for decades, not as Brother Shabaka pointed out, not only will those 14,000 be affected, the communities where they live and shop and work, there will be a triple effect, a ripple effect, and many and hundreds of workers will lose their jobs in those communities, and the communities mm-hmm. will take a hit. So we see the value of constantly putting profits before people. That's why we need mm-hmm. cooperative solutions that put people before profit. Go ahead, Sister Nanana.
Well, and I was just about to ask, so what does all of this activity with General Motors and what we're talking about in terms of wage slavery, what does all of that tell us concerning the future of cooperative economics and the plan that ULU is putting forth?
Well, one thing, the people are going to be laid off, all right, and they still have to live. And at some point, they have to look towards each other, all right, as to a means of the survival because the skills are there. And the brother said something very important. I remember in working when I was working at Bell Labs back in the 70s, Bell Labs had developed a battery, to be placed in cars. You know, I was not directly related working on that project, but I knew folks that were. So we go back to the 70s. And see, these people think decades in advance about what they want to do and how they want to profit from it. And right now the infrastructure is set to use fossil fuel. Obviously it will eventually be phased out, all right, but if they are making the determination when it will be phased out, by that time, you know, we could be have an atmosphere like Venus, unbreathable. So the cooperative economics is the model because it allows for ownership of the people gravely affected coming together, pooling their resources, and then using these resources as the brother Kambizi said, and I talked about earlier, the factory workers at GM can buy the plant. They got 14. I mean, they can buy a plant. They got the skills. They know of the orders coming in and out. They still can do those time management orders coming in and out. They know the products, all right, and they know the science. You got scientists there. You got engineers there, all right. They can do that. All they have to do is have a concept or mentality towards cooperative economics, and that's what we're moving towards because the capitalists don't like to always mention that word, but these are the capitalists, generals of industry right now, are only concerned about the profitability that they are able to acquire as a consequence of exploiting, all right, underclass. And right now we're the underclass. That's the African community in this country are the underclass. And it is important for us, all right, to move closer together, all right, because we do spend. We might look at ourselves as poor, but we do spend. The data says we spend $1.3 trillion last year, and we can do a lot with $1.3 trillion. That's larger than the economy of Mexico, a country, gross national product. So we have the capabilities. We now have to put in the energy and foresight.
Well, Brother Shabaka, on that point, let's pivot in the time that we have remaining to say a few things about Cafe Ulu, which is a project of Us Lifting Us. It's a cooperatively owned and operated coffee house and internet lounge operated in Atlanta, where everyone that is a member of Us Lifting Us is a part owner in Cafe Ulu. So, Brother Shabaka, in the few moments that we have left, help our listeners to begin to understand how group ownership, family-centered economics, community-owned businesses are the future for our people. And quiet as it's kept for the planet.
Yeah, like I said, you're forced to move towards us because you're being exploited and you're left alone. We see three steps. One, a group of us pool our resources. All right, that's our financial resources and the skills and intellect that we bring. We're going to use these resources that we pool together, both financial, material, intellectual, and create member-owned businesses which will produce jobs, all right, and salaries, all right, for the workers who are members. All right. Now, I want to say that again. You got groups of folks coming together, your members, all right, pool your resources, use those resources to identify member-owned businesses and create jobs and provide salaries and dividends for members who are workers, all right? And so you mentioned Cafe Ulu. Cafe Ulu is a venture by Us Lifting Us, but it's very important that folks understand why we got into coffee. A lot of people don't realize, you know, coffee is the second most traded commodity on the international exchange, second only to oil. Let me say that again. Coffee is the second largest, and during that period in the 70s, it was the first because oil wasn't being traded during that period of time. All right, there was some finagling going on, but coffee is the second largest trading commodity on the international exchange. So it's not by, smoking guns that we decided that this is a venture. Coffee houses are springing up, and coffee is a commodity, and everybody's talking about the benefit of coffee. But that, brother, I hope I know you wanted to say more, but that's essentially it. Pull our resources together, use the resources that we pull together to create businesses, and then use those businesses to create jobs for ourselves. And the jobs for
right.
ourselves and owners of those are our members.
And as those businesses begin to generate a surplus, then that surplus is used to build institutions in the community and also comes back to the members as a dividend, quarterly or semi-annually or annually. So it's a win-win situation. We redirect the resources, we employ ourselves, we provide the goods and services that our communities need. We use the surplus to do things like health care and education, and also dividends to come back to our members. And these are institutions that we can pass forward to future generations. We would just say, as we get ready to go out, members and listeners, mark your calendars March 15th, 16th, and 17th of 2019. Is the Us Lifting Us annual members convention and meeting. It's going to be in Atlanta, Georgia at the ITC on Martin Luther King Drive in West End, Atlanta. And we're excited, and you'll be hearing more information as we come closer to that date. So again, March 6th, 15th, 16th, and 17th, mark your calendars, get ready for the Us Lifting Us annual convention and members meeting. Brother Shabaka, thank you so much for sharing with our audience tonight. Sister Nanana, thank you for being with us. Brother Jelani, we appreciate your energy. Members, we'll see you next Thursday, 9 o'clock, same time, same channel. Stay strong, be well. Peace.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, 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 oh. Wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you